The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show.
On Relevant Radio.
The Drew Mariani Show. On Relevant Radio.
Welcome back to the Drew Mariani Show. I'm Sheila Logminas. Drew Mariani is taking a good few days off. That's needed, as we all need. And I'm in for Drew. He'll be back tomorrow, and I'm in the middle of a conversation right now with Bishop Andrew Cousins. He's Auxiliary Bishop of the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis. We're talking about the Eucharist and many Catholics, as you know, falling away from the faith, not attending Mass anymore, not believing in the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, in the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ, in the body, in the Eucharist. And do they come to church but not believe that? Or do they just fall away because they don't believe any of it? The worship, they weren't getting anything out of it. Well, it's not supposed to entertain you. It's what are you putting into it? But that's just me kind of riffing for a second. I should get off my riff and go back to Father Cousins, Bishop Cousins, who is answering your questions as well as mine. The phones are open, 888-914-9149. Bishop, sorry, it took me forever, a long time, and a lot of other people too, and he laughs about it to this day, to stop calling Bishop Barron, Father Barron. So when I called you Father Cousins, I did corrected that quickly, but that must happen a lot. So I've known you, though, to be Bishop Cousins for a long time, and I'm very, very, very humbly grateful to have you in today and enormously pleased because you are in to talk about this, what we talk about with such love. And it's not just an issue. It's the Eucharist. It's the centrality of everything. So as I said, Bishop, we have some calls waiting for you. Lauren is calling in from Long Beach, California, and she's been holding. So I want to go to Lauren right now. Thanks for calling, Lauren. Go ahead.
Well, thank you so much. I want to make a comment. I love the Eucharist now and the power of the Eucharist and the presence of the Lord when I'm in the church receiving, but there was a time that I took it for granted. I didn't really realize how much a part of my life strengthened me, the forgiveness that comes through the Eucharist, the joy that I get from it, and it was shown very powerfully when I joined the ministry to detention, juvenile detention for 12 to 18-year-olds. I was terrified, but I really felt called to go and share the catechesis for that Sunday morning. Well, when I go to Mass with the other volunteers, it was powerful when I went in. The kids were open. I mean, their arms were closed. These were gangbangers. And, you know, and we never knew what they did because Sister wouldn't tell us their offenses. We just went in with an open heart and with the Word of God. But the days I missed Mass, either at my home parish or that morning, I was a dud. I had nothing to give. And I worked myself up and got excited, but I could tell in the room the kids weren't receiving as powerful. But once I started seeing that it was from the Eucharist, I started begging God, speak to me, Father. It's you I'm receiving. Come in with me. Bring your love and your mercy and your forgiveness. And this is my biggest testimony of the Eucharist is when you don't take it in ministry, you will see mm-hmm. the difference. And I just encourage everybody that's in ministry of any kind, even if you're just a mom and dad, the power of the Eucharist just to carry you through the day with your kids is so powerful. Thank you so much.
Bishop Cousins, what about that, especially when people don't see, like, tangibly? I sometimes think how people are entertained these days, or how people, like, get things these days, or how what reaches them. And I know this sounds terrible, but it's a grabbable thought. And I know it's a thought experiment. But if there were a hologram in front of a monstrance in Eucharistic adoration, and they would see Jesus there, then how many more would believe? But he says, but you have seen and believed. But great are they who have not seen and they believe. So is it, what she's saying is it just that they need to, I don't know, they're not seeing it?
You know, that's such a powerful testimony we just heard because it shows right. It shows the real power of Jesus in the Eucharist. And Mother Teresa, Saint Teresa of Calcutta, you know, she spoke about this always, and it wasn't just a saying. She would say, you know, you will never love Jesus in the poor unless you love him in the Eucharist, and you will never love Jesus in the Eucharist unless you love him in the poor. And the point is that there's something that when I encounter the person of Jesus, it actually changes me. And what's beautiful is, I think it's Mona from California, she understood that. she could see it tangibly. There was a real effect of the Eucharist. And that's the way we see grace. We can't see grace in itself, but we can see its effects. We can see the effect of God's life in us. And when I encounter him, I was able to bring him more clearly. Such an important experience to be able to see that, especially when I do some kind of ministry, it's not me, it's Jesus in me. And if I've been away from the Eucharist, well, then, as Jesus said, that branch withers and dies and it doesn't produce fruit.
It is how we receive Jesus and how powerful that can be. And bishops, part of it is what? It really just prayerfully asking him to help us receive him with a more open heart and to be more like pushing out those thoughts that crowd our minds, that distract our attention, and really allowing ourselves to receive him fully. We just need to ask for that, right?
Yeah, I mean, disposition is really the key as we come to receive Jesus in the Eucharist. So first, that I've dealt with my own sinfulness, right? If I need to go to confession, as you said earlier, that's going to affect my disposition. And going to confession then actually cleans my heart and prepares me to receive him. But then you're right, it's the desire, it's what I put into it. You know, have I actually prayed with the Word of God before I came to Mass? Do I spend time in adoration, which actually prepares me to receive more from Holy Communion? That was St. John Paul II's line. He said, you know, the Eucharist is such a great mystery, I can't understand it all just by going to Mass. I need time in adoration outside of it to be able to understand and receive the love of Jesus, and that prepares my heart to receive him more in communion. But I think especially in those moments as I'm going to communion, to talk to Jesus as I'm approaching him at the altar, to tell him I want his love, to tell him what I need, you know, to ask for the graces I need, because he wants to give us that, and that focuses me on him and disposes my heart, as you're saying.
Disposing our hearts to receive him ahead of receiving him, and then going back to our pew and just, I think, closing our eyes, putting our heads down and allowing ourselves to fully speak to him, welcome him into our hearts. You know, say a Eucharistic prayer, if you can, Anima Christi, whatever prayer you choose, or just talk to him. But there are just so many ways. This is about Eucharistic revival, and I've got a couple more questions for you on that, but I want to allow listeners to ask you questions. So I'm going to take one right now for you, Bishop Cousins, from Jessica in West Orange, New Jersey. Jessica, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much. I appreciate you taking my call. I just was wondering if the bishops would consider Eucharistic processions and try to do that throughout the country and encourage it as part of this ministry, because I really think taking Jesus to the streets would really make a difference.
Love it.
Yes, absolutely, and that is one of our main goals. You know, we're still in the planning phase of this revival. This is what we're calling year zero, right? The first year of the revival will begin on Corpus Christi of next year, June 2022. And we are going to be proposing and resourcing every diocese in the country to have Eucharistic processions on that day, because we do want this to mark this Eucharistic revival. A scripture passage that always comes to me when I think of that is when our Lord says, "When I am lifted up, I will draw all people to myself." And that's what we do in a Eucharistic procession. We lift him up, and we show people how much we love him. And I even remember the story of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, who was an Episcopalian, was in Italy, saw a Eucharistic procession, and everybody, you know, dropped to their knees around her when the Eucharist came by, and she didn't even know what was going on. But she sensed the Lord's presence there, and that's what led her into the Catholic Church, ultimately, and she became a saint. But so it was a Eucharistic procession that started her conversion.
That leads to a question I'm going to try to fit in before you go, but I want to also fit in a caller here from Iowa. So let's go to her. Jean is calling in from Iowa for Bishop Andrew Cousins, and we're going to take that call right now. Jean, go ahead. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. How do you tactfully tell your children who you know are not practicing our faith or attending Mass on Sunday to not receive the Eucharist when they do attend?
That's a very good question. Mm-hmm. And it really requires a lot of prudence, right? Because we want to be able to say it in a way that's still inviting, because we're glad they're coming, but we also want them to understand the reality of it. And I think it's simply to say something like, you know, going to communion is such a sacred thing. If you're not ready, it's okay, you know, because we want to reverence that. And sometimes you can have the relationship when you're not at Mass. You can have the conversation when you're not at Mass about what that means. And, of course, encouraging them to go to confession beforehand. The key is that witness, right? You can witness to how important it is and how sacred it is, and just let them know that, you know, we should only do it when we're prepared. And sometimes it's just as simple as suggesting that they get a blessing. Always trusting that the Lord in His mercy is going to help us work that out.
You know, the Lord in His mercy also is something else we receive from the Eucharist, from communion. And I loved the caller saying, why don't we just take Jesus to the streets? And you talked about Corpus Christi Sunday, Eucharistic revival. And this is so powerful. I have a quick question for you, Bishop Cousins, before we wrap up. And that's, among other questions, I'll just maybe leave be until another time. But why doesn't the church talk more? Maybe the church does talk a lot, and through authors and through bishops and priests who come on shows and do their own writing. But why don't we all talk more about Eucharistic miracles? When you think about what you just said about Elizabeth Ann Seton sensing the presence of Jesus when she saw people drop to their knees. I mean, that's in itself sort of a Eucharistic miracle, but there are those Eucharistic miracles that are just jaw-dropping, that themselves witness to people who hear about that.
It's true. You know, I just got a letter today from someone who was telling me that they came to a true understanding of the real presence through a display on Eucharistic miracles that happened in our archdiocese. Mm-hmm. And you might be familiar with Blessed Carlos Acutis, who's a new young person who was beatified in Assisi, who had a great devotion to these Eucharistic miracles and developed a website. Imagine this, he's just blessed and he developed a website on Eucharistic miracles. So we definitely have plans to have Eucharistic miracles as part of the revival. And we've even talked about a traveling display. You know, we'd love to bring one of them. You know, they exist in places. There is one in Argentina. I you know, would love to try to see if we could bring a Eucharistic miracle here to the United States so that they could be seen and witnessed by people. Because miracles are always meant to be a help to faith. They don't prove things for those who are doubters, right? But for those who are open, it can be a real help to faith.
Exactly. Eucharistic miracles are just so awesome and jaw-dropping. They are witnesses, true witnesses. You can't deny them. Well, some people can not believe them, but they are amazing witnesses to the real presence of something of heaven touching down on earth, like some other miracles. And it's just one more way you can introduce to others books, displays, as you said, about Eucharistic miracles. Bishop Andrew Cousins, there's so much more. I could talk to you for another hour about this if we had time, but we don't. Thank you for being here today and talking about Eucharistic revival, the importance and centrality of the Eucharist, calling others back by inviting them, witnessing to them what the power of the Eucharist in your own life, the power of the liturgy, of the holy sacrifice of the Mass, of going to church. I mean, just the ways we invite people and talk about this makes a difference. And as I said, people can't unhear what they've heard. Bishop Andrew Cousins, thank you for your witness.
Thank you so much. And please pray for the revival.
Amen. Everybody heard that. Coast to coast, you heard Bishop Andrew Cousins asking you to pray for the Eucharistic revival starting right now. Pray now, all the way through not just a year, all the way through into the future. How powerful are those prayers for Eucharistic revival in our country, in the world, the global church? We need to be, as a universal church, out there all over the world making a difference in the world. We can change the world, one person, one heart at a time. If enough people did that, look at what the early church did. The early church did that in so many ways, and we are an ongoing sort of early community of faith, if you will. It depends on, God alone knows when this all ends, but we are like the early church, continuing the witness that they gave. Well, on that note, we continue to be people in the public forum, of the public arena, the public square, with our different professions, our different occupations. What we do, the work we do in the world, has to be imbued with our faith. We receive the sacraments, and then we have our beliefs, and then we go out, and that should matter to how we do what we do. Joining me from the medical profession about different difficult topics in the medical field, especially bioethics. That's a big one, and I love topics of bioethics. I'm going to be talking next with a doctor in this. So as you heard yesterday in my interview with Walt Heyer, Texas Governor Greg Abbott is planning to implement a bill that would have disallowed hormone therapy, puberty suppressants, and transition-related surgeries for minors that couldn't pass because of a legislative roadblock. But the need for that bill, such a bill, illustrates just how complex the practice of medicine is getting these days. Even 15 years ago, a doctor wouldn't have thought about saying to a young patient, "Those thoughts you're having about being the opposite sex, there's a way to fix that, you know." No. Nor would, and many doctors be confronted with a teenager asking to be made into the opposite sex, or with parents of three-year-olds, demanding that their child be transitioned. Oh my gosh, what's going on here? But that kind of thing is happening on a regular basis now. On a regular basis now. And it's probably going to get worse before it gets any better. Navigating this ethical minefield is tough for physicians. Be aware of that. Dr. Allison Tobola knows it firsthand. She's a sports medicine specialist at Christus Trinity Clinic in Tyler, Texas. She's recently completed a bioethics program at the University of Mary in Bismarck, North Dakota, and she's already putting her knowledge to work at the clinic and hospital where she works. Dr. Tobola, welcome. I'm glad you're here.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
That's just one issue. The sex transitioning, puberty blocking hormones, young ages. This is going to get worse. Right now, I've covered bioethics for so many years, Dr. Tobola. These issues are burgeoning. They're just growing and exponentially, and they're growing deeper and wider and far more serious. So, you know, you're now prepared in this, especially lately in the University of Mary Bismarck bioethics program you've just completed, and you're implementing it. How much pushback do you get from people who are imbued with cultural ideologues?
It's definitely difficult. I'm really thankful that I was able to have the opportunity to study at University of Mary. It was an excellent program where I received my master's in bioethics, and they offer a lot of different seminars to help even people who may not want to immerse themselves in a full master's degree covering these issues and helping us as Catholics and being able to articulate why the church teaches what she does. But it definitely is very challenging to have these conversations with people in the culture and people who may not fully understand the Catholic anthropology, you know, what the Catholic Church teaches about the human person and about the fact that we are created as human persons, you know, willed by God as male and female, and that this is a good thing. And we have this inalienable dignity created who we are, and that we're body, soul, persons. And so that understanding of who the human person is, that we're not just a soul who has a body as an instrument, but our body is a part of who we are, and it's really important. And so trying to help people who have not necessarily grown up with that understanding, or who are not being taught that understanding of the human person, is very challenging.
It is very challenging when there is that prevailing idea out there of the duality. You know, it's just a shell. We're just carrying a soul, if people even talk about the soul. But this is very important, a part of bioethics, because Catholics do have that teaching and understanding of human flourishing, the fully integrated human person, the fully integrated human being. And that's why we look at people with the inherent dignity they have, and we treat people, especially you in medicine, as the whole person, body, soul, mind and spirit. But Dr. Tobola, just to put this out there, you're an orthopedist. So to tell people the range in medicine of fields in which doctors may still have to face difficult questions in bioethics, you're an orthopedist, but that would seem to be one of the less ethically complicated specialties. Is that impression wrong?
One of the things in medicine is that anytime we're involved with diagnosis or caring for patients, it really, every decision we make does entail an ethical as well as a medical dimension. But sometimes the ethical issues are more straightforward. And so it is in the field of like sports medicine and orthopedics, sometimes the ethical dimension of what we do is easier to navigate, and is not necessarily to the point where it becomes gray or becomes an absolute dilemma. But there are still some situations where that do come up. A lot of times, I would say one of the biggest issues is going to be when patients lack medical decision-making, where they're not able to fully understand what you're trying to communicate to them about their issue and about the treatment. And so trying to determine if a patient has or lacks medical decision-making is a very common issue sometimes across the fields. And so we have to try to identify when and if a surrogate decision maker is needed to be able to get informed consent. So that's a very common, I would say, ethical dilemma that many specialties across the board would face. And so that's probably number one, I would say, that we deal with no matter where you are. But, you know, as you mentioned with the transgender situation, that I foresee that becoming an issue. I do sports medicine, so we do cover a lot of high school and college athletes and take care of them. And so there may be some dilemmas that arise in that field related to transgender, but it hasn't been something that has intimately been a part of my practice just yet. We have not encountered it, but it is something I see that could be an issue. But as you mentioned, bioethics is a wide range of ethical issues. There's issues at the beginning of life, end of life, and then everywhere in between. And my hope is to be able to use my degree to help ethicists at the hospital, to help educate the laity, to be a resource for the priests and religious and bishops. Just being able to have that medical background plus this knowledge of Catholic bioethics to help in a variety of areas.
In fact, in a variety of areas, now that you completed the bioethics program at University of Mary, so far, have there been, what kind of demands are you seeing, if you've seen any yet, for what you've learned? Because, you know, you've got this training, but most doctors don't. So a lot of them are confronted with the same things you are, or maybe even more so in whatever their specialties are. How do they make decisions without that kind of help? And are some turning to you?
I definitely think it's challenging. And that's one thing I learned through this program also, was how much I didn't fully understand and how much I really wasn't exposed to in that field of bioethics before I started to be more intentional about the seminars that I attended or the types of resources I was reading and using. So I think there is a big gap of knowledge for sure. But I have seen a lot of people reaching out to want to get more education. And so they have been reaching out to me to offer some education for physicians and nurses. Definitely, I talked to the pastor at my local parish, and I'm going to start to institute a program for even just lay people. I think there's a lot of knowledge that I can pass on to the lay people as well. And then, you know, hopefully down the road, being able to be a resource for even priests or other people in our diocese.
Well, Doctor, there certainly is a widespread need for a better understanding of bioethical issues among the laity, people in general, whether it's someone in their family, they themselves. There's so much in bioethics. We're low on time, but I wanted to get that in there and make sure that people know this is something. So ethical decision making, you know, end of life issues, treatment issues, signing forms at hospitals. I'm so glad you mentioned ethics committees. Well, you've got to talk to the ethics, you know, panels or committees in hospitals when you can. Those of you who are trained in moral bioethics programs, such as, you know, you have been at University of Mary, because some of these ethics panels are, I mean, we've heard about, you know, healthcare rationing and there being a calculus of treatment based upon, you know, expected quality of life and the age of the patient and so forth. That kind of calculus can enter into moral medicine. So it's so important that you've had this bioethics training. And that other doctors now know, and the laity and your parish, they know they can turn to you for answers to questions. Inevitably, most people are going to face at some point for themselves or for a loved one. So, people can find you online. I'm sure Dr. Allison Tobola, sports medicine specialist at Christus Trinity Clinic in Tyler, Texas. And they can find you at that website, right?
Yes, definitely. And, you know, my parish is the Cathedral of the Immaculate Conception. They can reach out and they'll be able to direct them to me.
That's great.
The National Catholic Bioethics Center is also a great resource, always,
right,
as well as University of Mary. So they can reach out to University of Mary and they'll be able to direct them to me as well.
That's great. And certainly Relevant Radio has them on a lot. University of Mary, Father Tapaholchik, National Catholic Bioethics Center. Dr. Tabola, it's been great talking with you. Thank you for your voice and your witness.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio and on the Relevant Radio app.
Hi, this is the Drew Mariani Show. I'm Sheila Logminas. Drew is off for a few days. Just taking a few days off, as we all need to. This is a good time to do that. I'm filling in as he does, but he'll be back tomorrow. We're moving on into so many great topics today. Time flies, doesn't it? Bishop Cousins was great to have in on the Eucharist and Eucharistic revival, and what a great shepherd's gentle voice, calm clarity, just utter the essence of faith. And the essence of our faith is Eucharist. So we live that out in all of our professions, as I said in the lead up to introducing Dr. Tabola a little bit ago, on bioethics in a training she received at the University of Mary and takes into her world in medicine. And so this is every profession, law, medicine, academia, wherever, media. Oh, that's a big one for me. The importance of words and communications. Communication is a moral act. John Paul II taught that, wrote that in some of his writing documents that I use as a mission statement, especially one in particular. Communication is a moral act. Everything we do has to be imbued with our faith and the truth of our faith. Nothing that's relativistic in this culture. So, you know what? What do you do in the military when you're told things are changing? Things are changing everywhere. So do you just succumb? Well, sometimes you have to. With so many calls for equity out there, think about this. There are people who are pushing for women to be equally called up in times of war. You've heard of that, right? It's not new, but it's back in the news again. Right now, of course, the military is all voluntary and there's no draft. But should the time come when there's a war, oh, God forbid, but should that time come that requires more personnel than those who volunteer, U.S. law currently requires young men between the ages of 18 and 26 to register their names with the Selective Service. Those names are kept on file just in case a draft is required. But as I said, people are pushing for women to be drafted, and a three-year, $45 million National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service just issued a report saying that young women between the ages of 18 and 26 should also be required to sign up with a Selective Service. Why it took 3 years and $45 million to write that kind of report is beyond me. But that's a good question for another time. But given the current cultural atmosphere, it comes as no surprise, sadly. The reason the commission used to reach that conclusion, what they said, it's pretty slim. It's simply, the time is right. Well, that's say enough. And that's it. That's all they said. The time is right for this. It looks like they're escaping an answer, right? Elaine Donnelly is the president of the Center for Military Readiness. You can find them online at cmrlink.org. Elaine, welcome to the program. I'm glad you're here. This is a thorny issue.
Yes. Well, thank you, Sheila. It's good to talk with you today. Yes, it is a thorny issue. It's one that we've been dealing with for a long time.
I know, but now here it is, it's not just women in the military, it's not just women and men serving, you know, in the same, I don't know, ranks. It's now up to the level of the draft and registering with a Selective Service. So, and then when, how many years? All those 3 years and $45 million to write this report, and their answer, the commission, as I just said, used to reach that $45 million and use it for 3 years, is simply, the time is right. Time is right now to have women register with the Selective Service. So Elaine, was that really the entire reasoning for why women, they say, should sign up in the Selective Service? The time is right?
That was pretty much it, those four words. You see, that way they didn't have to talk about the facts that would argue that, no, the time is not right. There is no right time for Congress to pass bad laws that both harm women and undermine our military, that would make military readiness and mobilization at the worst possible time, a national emergency, requiring reinstating the draft. I mean, it's hard to imagine that even happening. But if it did happen, if this recommendation is carried out, Congress puts it into law, you would hurt both women, you would hurt national security, it would jam things up so badly in our military, it would certainly not advantage or help the United States. And yet the commission pretty much glossed over all of the details and the facts that should have been part of their record. They just kind of buried them. That's why we have taken a stand. Actually, we have for a long time. I did file a statement with the commission and with the Senate Armed Services Committee. But if you look at it only as a matter of equity, you say, oh, well, that's only fair. Well, no, it isn't fair. There are many reasons why. When you look at the military, the draft, if you're talking about a national emergency, you're talking about physical capabilities for combat operations, not support roles, not being in the Marine Band, even supply roles, things like that. We're talking about combat troops, combat replacements. Now, in that category, very few women would be fully qualified to do what men can do in the same situation. If you said, well, we're going to call up everybody, 50-50, men and women, what you do is you jam up the system so badly, you can't find the people who are qualified as opposed to those who are not. So for this reason, Congress should say, no, women have always volunteered to serve. You know, people forget this. They say, oh, we have to be fair, and you know, women should have to carry the same burden. The truth is, they already do. Women have always volunteered to serve in time of war, and they are used in many different areas. Actually, everything is wide open to women right now. We don't need to have selective service registration of young women, but that's what this legislation would do because this commission set up by the late John McCain, because they recommended it. I should add that you know what the real goal is here? Mm. It's not just selective service. It's national service. This commission did not endorse mandatory national service, not yet. But what they have called for is a very elaborate, expensive national bureaucracy, a cabinet-level position, a national council on military, national, and public service to commandeer the lives of young people for 2 years, both men and women. Now, this is what I think John McCain's goal really was. Because some people say, well, we don't have to worry about draft our daughters because, oh, girls can go and serve in national service. Well, wait a minute. Where does it say in the Constitution that anybody, any American, has to serve their government for 2 years? Do we have a presumption of freedom or a presumption of service to the government? You see where this is going? Yeah, if the government can commandeer lives for 2 years for not very good reasons, that is a loss of freedom for everybody. And that's why this commission's report, it's mostly about national service. There are some good ideas in there. I actually submitted some ideas that they did adopt, I and others did.
Good
ideas, I think, to encourage patriotic service in our military. But they've gone way too far. Their conclusions were pretty much predetermined because of the people who were appointed to the commission. We don't need a big government bureaucracy commandeering young people for 2 years out of their lives.
Well, it is a big bureaucracy, and that's exactly what happened. And when you make such a good point of the makeup of the commission, and then therefore the conclusion is preconceived. What kinds of evidence, Elaine, what kinds of evidence did this commission ignore about why women shouldn't be drafted into the military?
Well, they ignored the most comprehensive study of women in combat roles that has ever been done in history and likely will ever be done in history. It was done by the United States Marine Corps for 3 years. It included field tests. They compared the performances of both mixed gender units and all male units. And these were just average men. They were not supermen. And then they had the mixed gender units, and it was found that in 69% of the evaluated tasks, including hiking under load, the all-male units did much better than the mixed gender units. This study also found that injuries were 2 to 6 times higher among women. We also know, based on other research, that health problems, including infertility and higher risks of suicide, are much higher among women. Female attrition is twice as high in units as in units that used to be all male. And then even more recently, there's something called the Army Combat Fitness Test, ACFT. This is a substitute for what used to be the PFT, physical fitness test. Now, here's the difference. This new test is supposed to be gender neutral. It's supposed to treat men and women the same. It's supposed to take the same test and presumably perform at the same levels. Well, guess what? In the preliminary test, 84% of the women failed. So they made some adjustments. And they still had very, very high failure rates among the female soldiers. And now they're trying to disguise those failures by saying, well, we'll compare women's performance against other women and men against other men, and we'll have percentile comparison, the top 5% of women, the top 5% of men, and then we'll pretend that the top 5% of both, that they're essentially the same. No, they're not. Delusions like that don't work in a combat environment. It's the ultimate reality where you cannot play games with equality or pretending that men and women are interchangeable. It just doesn't work out. And I hasten to add this. If you're talking about courage and patriotism, willingness to serve, of course women are the equals of men, and in many cases even greater. But when you're talking about physical demands, and we don't draft people just for support jobs, we're talking about marching under load, carrying heavy loads, being able to engage the enemy in the infantry. The infantry are the largest units that we have in the Army and the Marine Corps. So if it was necessary to call up troops to defend America, and it's more than what the all-volunteer force can handle, the last thing we need is to complicate that process with this social engineering project that really, the case for it has simply not been made. You can't say, well, it's time. That's not a good enough reason.
It certainly seems that way on the face of it, and what you just put your finger right on is this is social engineering. That's been going on for a very long time, and listening to everything you're saying about this is just mind-boggling. I'm taking notes, but that led me to think the whole time, the whole way through what you're sharing with us is, Elaine, this seems on the face of it so starkly obvious that this is an attempt to just erase, like so much else in the culture, the differences between men and women, male and female. I mean, I think there was a book banned recently that was simply called Girls and Boys, something about the difference between girls and boys. And I know Booksellers Association of America came out with this like profuse groveling apology that they even included some book in their box of books to, you know, book shop owners that talked about this, the difference between boys and girls. So this seems to want to erase that.
Yes. Well, this is a return of the feminist movement of the 1970s. This was one of the big debates about the Equal Rights Amendment, the reason why the ERA failed. It's artificially propped up because you have a government commission, $45 million over 3 years being spent to advocate for this agenda and to set up a bureaucracy to keep that pressure going. That part I'm even more concerned about, because draft our daughters, people, once they find out what that means, well, they can push back. But if you've got a government agency saying that everybody is required to work for the government or for private organizations that are approved by the government, okay, they're not going to have your son or daughter working for, say, a pro-life group or a church group or something that doesn't meet politically correct criteria, that isn't woke enough. Once the bureaucrats get to decide what happens with young people's lives, that can be pretty far-reaching. And it's important to say we all support volunteer service, of course, the Peace Corps, AmeriCorps. There's even an organization that says it's called the Do Good Institute. Okay, the Do Good Institute is at the University of Maryland. Well, people, if they want to volunteer, that's great. And if there's some way that the government can help in that regard with Peace Corps and AmeriCorps up to a certain limit, fine. Church groups. But there is no constitutional mandate that allows the government to do this.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
888-914-9149.
Welcome back to the Drew Mariani Show. Time's flying. I'm Sheila Logminas in for Drew for a few days while he takes a little time off, but he's coming back tomorrow. And we're almost wrapping up here, but I'm really happy to have Elaine Donnelly in. She's president of the Center for Military Readiness. And we're talking about a 3-year, $45 million national commission on military, national, and public service just releasing a report saying young women between the ages of 18 and 26 should also be required along with young men to sign up with a selective service in case there's a need for a draft. She's very, very well resourced on this, researched on this, knowledgeable on this, and documented on this. She really knows what she's talking about. 888-914-9149. She's got the answers. There wasn't good reasoning for this. And when the commission was asked the reason for reaching the conclusion to $45 million in 3 years to study it, to reach a conclusion that young women between 18 and 26 should register for the draft with a selective service, they simply said, the time is right. She said, no, it is not. She said the time is not right for Congress. The time is never right for Congress to act to harm women. And she said plenty else. This is an important conversation. And I have many more questions for her, but we just have enough, just so much time. So let's get into that, Elaine. When you said, when you brought up the Army Combat Fitness Test, I wanted to get to that. Can there be a gender neutral physical test? I heard how you said they did it, but can there be a gender neutral? It sounds crazy, but this is where we are. Physical test given to recruits, because it seems like what you were saying or what you did de facto say is that the Army Combat Fitness Test kind of lowered their expectations by changing it over to how they tested.
Well, the test is tough for both women and men. Mm-hmm. And they seem surprised that women are not able to succeed at the same rates as men. This is where theory clashes with reality. It just doesn't work. Now, the position of the Presidential Commission on which I served back in the 1990s, we looked at this issue very closely, and we said, well, you can have separate kinds of tests for men and women, score them differently, you can gender norm in preliminary training because they're going to go into different roles in the military, okay? But that would only work if women are not in the combat positions, things like the infantry, special operations forces, army, the artillery, where physical strength really does matter. If women are going into those units, then it has to be gender neutral. But the problem is women do not have the same type of physical strength as the men do. The evidence of that is overwhelming, and it's always been there. It was proven scientifically with 3 years of study that the Marine Corps did. The Commandant of the Marine Corps at the time, the general who was the commandant, exercised his right to ask for exceptions to the mandates under the Obama administration. This was General Joseph Dunford, who later became chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But General Dunford's request to keep the infantry all male and special operations forces was denied by the administration, the Obama administration. They said, well, we're not going to take your advice. We're going to do this anyway. So, because the military is the military, they salute, they follow orders, and they've been trying to make it work ever since. Well, guess what? The experiment is not working. It's just not working. Some women have succeeded in some pretty tough training. We have a few female women who have, or female soldiers who have gone through Ranger training. They're Ranger qualified. They have not joined the Ranger regiment, however. We don't have any female Navy SEALs. There are some areas where women still have not succeeded with the men, but they're doing, they've always served well in the military. But when you try to pretend that you're going to have equal numbers of men and women, you really, these gender quotas are complicating things. It's making it worse. When you have people in the Pentagon saying, well, we want our military to look like the rest of the world, no, you can't have equal numbers of men and women without lowering standards. That is going to hurt readiness for everybody. It will increase injuries for women, lower standards for men. How does that benefit the military? Well, it doesn't benefit the military at all. And that's why what we need are common sense policies. Mm-hmm. Let women, encourage women to serve, volunteer to serve, and men as well. If there is a national emergency, one of the recommendations that we made, and the commission also endorsed it, is first thing the president ought to do is ask for volunteers. You recall after 9/11, the President George W. Bush at the time did not ask for volunteers to join the military. Instead, he said to everybody, go shopping, be normal. No, he should have asked for volunteers for the armed forces. Next time around, maybe a president faced with such an emergency would do just that. I hope we never have to reinstate any kind of selective service draft. But it is reasonable, it is prudent to be prepared, And if you do that, you shouldn't set up a system that is made to fail. If you try to pretend that equal numbers, inducting or calling up equal numbers, sending them to find out if they're qualified, and find out only a small percentage of one group succeeds while the others are turned away, that doesn't make any sense. So Congress has the right to do this, by the way. The Supreme Court, in a case going, it dates back to the 1980s, but the Supreme Court said under Article 1, Section 8, that Congress decides policy matters like this, and the courts will defer to Congress if they make the right decision. I hope when they make the right decision. People who are concerned about this should get in touch with their own member of Congress. This is coming up in the Senate. We don't know exactly when. Their meetings are behind closed doors. Mm. On the House side, it likely will come up for a markup in the fall, in September. Okay. Everything's kind of skewed right now with the pandemic and everything else. But just let your member of Congress know. Don't even think about it. This is not a good idea, and the commission did not meet its expectations. They could have done a much better job in putting out all the facts, not just the facts that they wanted to support the idea of women being subject to registration for selective service.
Yeah, and that's a selective social engineering project, as you put it, to erase the true differences between men and women as if there aren't any. And in fact, they come out when you say, marching under load, there are huge differences between men and women. Engaging the enemy, there are huge differences, and they just have to be acknowledged. In the commission you referred to, National Commission on Military, National, and Public Service, who is behind this, I'm really glad to hear you say, Elaine, that this policy will come up before a Senate committee or panel. And it will come up at some point in the fall in the House. I know what you mean, the political process being what it is, it's really hard to get things done. But it's really good to hear you say it's going to come up in both houses of Congress. And all the time
right.
Their
report actually came out last year, but because of the pandemic, they're only looking at it now. But I can tell you this, the Senate has not had a hearing in 30 years on the subject of women in combat.
Oh, my gosh.
Can you imagine? I was there. 1991, I was there. And it was a thorough job. When they looked at the issue at that time, and it was they established a presidential commission. I was appointed to that commission, studied the issue for a full year. But after the commission's work was done, they didn't have any hearings on the Senate side or the House side. They just kind of swept it under the rug. Instead, the only kinds of hearings they have are things like sexual misconduct, sexual assault, all these social issues and problems, many of which are the result of recommendations from the same people making recommendations today. The Rand Corporation, for instance, the usual feminist groups, they never acknowledge the mistakes they have made in the past. Social engineers never acknowledge their mistakes. And that's part of the problem. That's why Congress needs to do their job, oversight. They need to look at all the data, including data that the Obama administration swept under the rug. Why did General Dunford ask for exceptions? Well, the actual memo that he sent has been withheld from public view. The first thing I asked this commission to do was, you need to get that memorandum. You need to make it public. It never was made public. And it's still being withheld from public view. And that's unfortunate because we paid $36 million for that research, among other things. And we do know many of the findings, but we need to see the recommendations made by the commandant at the time. He had every right to ask for exceptions. He was given that option. He was turned down. We need to know why.
We do, and it's really good that you raise these questions, and people need to contact their members of Congress, both on the House and Senate side, before they're voting on this, before they're even deliberating on it, that you let them know you now know it's coming. And listen again to the audio in the podcast of this show, and listen again to Elaine Donnelly. Elaine, we're out of time. I was going to bring up again that you said that this commission did not endorse national service, just military service. We want national service. That's another conversation.
They did call for national service, not mandatory, not yet.
Yeah,
but
right,
that's where they're going with it.
What good information. We need to be informed with all of this when we call our members of Congress. Thank you, Elaine Donnelly, so much.
Thank you. So nice to talk with you.
And thank you all. It's been great to talk with you.
Our spiritual director, Father Michael Hurley, a Dominican priest, in the Archdiocese of San Francisco, talking about finding time for silence in our lives.
The Inner Life with Josh Raymond.
Now, what if that silence scares us, Father? If somebody's listening and saying, I don't want to be in that silence, any good advice for them?
Yeah, Nike, just do it. What scares us is the isolation. And the reality, though, is that being distracted and being kind of immersing ourselves in the exterior world can be more isolating than we realize. We think we're connecting, but we're not really connecting. True connection is a language of love. And so to, in a sense, embrace the fear of isolation, or at least the challenge of isolation, because on the other side, like walking through the doorway, like death itself, is the fullness of God's presence. If we are bold and courageous enough to enter into that silence.
I love that.
The Inner Life with Josh Raymond. Weekdays at 11 a.m. Central on Relevant Radio.
There was a kid who went to his mother and said, Mom, if God is real, why can't we see him? And she says, I'm busy now. Go ask your father. And he says, Dad, how come if God is real, we can't see him? And he says, go ask your mother. I'm busy. So the kid is going fishing with Grandpa. One of these beautiful, cool mornings. Oh, and the lake is like glass. He says, Grandpa, if God is real, how come we can't see him? And the old man, he looks away. And the kid thinks, yeah, Grandpa's blowing me off too. Well, then he looks at the kid after a couple of minutes and he says, Junior, at this point in my life, God is pretty much all I can see. You see, as we grow in grace, God becomes only more beautiful. And things we thought were important or special or desirable, be they wealth or fame, they become much less important. So he moves us from grace unto grace. But at any point in that chain, I can say, no, I prefer the world. And we're great fools if we do so.
Father Simon Says
on Relevant Radio.